Am I good? All right. I'm Zach, and I'm an alcoholic. All right. Is that better? Can you hear me now? All right. Once again, I'm Zach, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. I have a sobriety date of March 21st, 2013. If you do the math, it's a little less than 2.5 years sober. I apologize in advance. I will vaguely be talking about drugs, but I will not be going into certain details about them. So if you get offended, I guess I'm sorry in advance. I'm really not, but we'll just say it for the tape. Okay, so I guess we will start in the beginning. That's a great place to start, right? All right, some of you know me. I make the coffee here. If you enjoy it, that's great for you. Go to Starbucks if you want good coffee. And I secretary a meeting on Saturday nights that a lot of you attend. I am not originally from Visalia, and I did not originally get sober in Visalia or Tulare County. So I will show you how we did it down south. I was originally from the Los Angeles area. I grew up in a very interesting home. It was a pretty good childhood, to tell you the truth. It wasn't like I got beat or any of that. I grew up with a deaf father, a mother that was a teacher, and then me and my sister. And we grew up pretty good. I was raised in Sylmar, California, which is the north city of the San Fernando Valley. And in about junior high, we moved to basically the suburbs of Los Angeles. We moved to the northern city of Santa Clarita. For those of you that don't know, that's where Magic Mountain is. Yay, roller coasters. I basically had a hard time, man, adjusting when I moved there. I didn't have any friends. I came from a predominantly Asian neighborhood. I don't know how that works, but a predominantly Asian neighborhood. We just kind of did our thing, you know, destructive kids, throw our toys in the street and all that. And I moved out to Santa Clarita, and I didn't feel like I fit in at all, man. There was a lot of rich, spoiled white kids, and I remember the first day of school, man. They were acting the fool. And Sylmar, I lived basically on this pretty main street. It was Laurel Canyon and Hubbard Boulevard, and a lot of traffic. And I remember when I got to the first day of school out there in Saugus, which is in Santa Clarita, man, these kids were like running in the street, dodging cars, and I'm thinking, don't do that where I'm from, man. Somebody's going to hit you. So I didn't feel like I related at all. I didn't want to run in the street and be cool. So I had a really hard time fitting in, man. I really was just looking for somebody to hang out with, and I don't know if it was peer pressure or acceptance or whatnot, but I found a couple hoodlums, to put it in nice perspective. I found a couple hoodlums to hang out with and started stealing stuff from school, and, you know, they kind of accepted me a little bit. That was the eighth grade year, so that was 2006. I was invited, it was May or April of 2006, I was invited after school to go partake in some smoking of some marijuana and some alcohol, and drink some alcohol. So we went over there. I had no idea what was going to happen or what was the effects were going to be like. They threw me a can of warm Tecate, which is disgusting on its own when it's cold, and even more nasty when it's warm. So we drank this can of warm Tecate, poked a couple holes in it, smoked some pot out of it, and then they threw me a cigarette. So I was a triple whammy from the get-go. All in about 15 minutes, I had my first beer, drug, and cigarette. And it was cool. I had a good time. I'm not going to sit there and say that it was like the worst thing ever in the world. So a couple months go by, we were still stealing some stuff from school, and eventually all of us got caught. A little bit of probation and some community service entailed. And we all got pretty much split up into different high schools after that. So I had to find a new group of friends, and I really just couldn't fit in anywhere. Tried hanging out with the Asians. They were kind of doing their own thing. I'm not a martial arts expert. That's the kind of stuff they like. Tried to hang out with the white kids. Once again, that didn't work. Other people. And then started hanging out with some gangsters, man. I don't know if I played a little too much Grand Theft Auto when I was a kid or watched too many R-rated movies, but I got attracted to that. So we started doing that and started getting in fights in school and getting kicked out of different high schools, and ended up in this one troublesome high school. I think there was like 60 of us. Most of us were, alcoholics and gangsters or gangbangers, whatever you want to call it. I felt like I was at home, man. I started going to school, and we would cut class. There used to be this go-kart and mini golf place right behind the school, so we would go hop the fence, do our little drinking, and then go ride go-karts, and then go back to class. That was cool. I enjoyed that. that's the kind of stuff that we would do. We would fight after school at the bus stop and all that. And I met this girl, sophomore year of high school, we eventually got into a relationship. She kind of became the high school sweetheart, went to prom and all that, and she eventually graduated, and I was left by myself, and I ended up getting a little bit of trouble. I got a tobacco and truancy ticket. I remember this. I hated this. I got a tobacco and truancy ticket when I was in high school. I said, okay, that's nothing. I'll do a couple hours of community service, maybe pay a small fine. When I get to the courtroom, my mom stands up in the middle. I was 17 at the time. My mom stands up in the middle of the courtroom and says, hey, put him in VITA. I'm not going to pay the ticket. For those of you that don't know what VITA is, in the L.A. County, it is basically a mini boot camp. So 7 days a week, you go after school and go do push-ups with the Marines and the L.A. County Sheriffs and move some cinder blocks and railroad beams. So I was like, cool, this sucks. I don't want to do this. It was a six-month program. I actually did really well with it. I cleaned up my act. I stopped doing the fighting after school and after-school special with alcohol and stuff. I thought I was straight. I didn't know at this time that I was an alcoholic of some sorts. And I would like to say that was probably my first time of being dry drunk or abstinence. And that was short-lived. Maybe a few months after I graduated that program, I was right back to doing what I was doing. Not even of the understanding that I was an alcoholic. So that was, when I look back at that, I understand how the disease works of actually needing a program of alcoholics to stay sober, because I couldn't have done it by myself. A few months goes by, keep getting kicked out of mom's house and couch hopping and living in cars and whatnot. I end up having this child with the woman I took to prom, and that was July 29th of 2011. My son was born, and I was excited for it, but we had really, like, how do I put this? I pretty much was like a deadbeat at that time, no job, unemployed, living on the couch, so understandably, she didn't really want me to be around him, and it was okay for the first few months when he was born, but it very quickly turned sour. So I will fast forward a little bit to 2012, basically the last 6 months before I got sober. I was sleeping on the couches. I had this car. I lost the car. I was driving on a suspended license. I lost the car for speeding. Got kicked out of the couch, off the couch. And I ended up living in a tent, kind of like a gazebo, you know, they got the canvas walls and stuff. I ended up living in a gazebo next to Castaic Lake during the winter time. And the conditions were horrid, man. I was broke as a joke. I didn't have any money to go eat. I had a backpack with two pairs of clothes, holes in my pants. I had this long hair that I thought looked good, kind of like a MacGyver mullet. But when you grow hair in the back and you don't grow it in the front, it looks horrible. Yeah, I got a really bad receding hairline. So it looks horrible when you do that, but I thought I looked amazing. I was living in the tent, man. The Santa Ana winds came in, ripped the roof off the tent. So when it rained on us. I was waking up with flies on my face. I think I was about 115 pounds. And, man, that just beat me up real quick. I couldn't hang. Sorry for you guys that can do that for long periods of time. I couldn't hang. I quit. You know, I did that, and I basically just came to my mom. She said, "You can't come back here, but I'll help you." I said, I can't live in these conditions anymore. So on March 19th, we went and saw this reverend on the other side of town, and he said he had this sober living. I said, "Oh, okay, what's that about? I've never heard of a sober living." So he said, "Okay, what I want you to do is come back in the morning and come to these two meetings in the morning." One of them was an AA meeting. I was like, "I've never been to an AA meeting. What the hell is AA?" So that night was the last time that I drank. I went and bought a Mickey tall can from the 7-Eleven, drank half of it, threw up, and then I went and to my neighbor's house and bought a little bit of pot, and we smoked some weed in his ice cream truck. I can't make this stuff up, people. I really can't. These stories are so outlandish. And we smoked weed in the back of his ice cream truck. That was the last time I got high. Next morning I went to, express really the bottom, man. I was so beat up after losing everything. The car, the family support, you know, not eating, losing my son. I just basically felt I had lost everything in life except for my own life, and I tried to take that. I tried to hang myself from the second banister of the stairs, and that obviously didn't happen because I'm here today. The next day, that was the 19th. The 20th was the last day I got high. The next day I saw the reverend and he said, "Come back for the meeting." So I go back to these meetings on the 21st. That was the first day I was sober for a whole day. He said, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous not knowing what the hell was going on. I was beat up, still had my long MacGyver mullet and holy blue jeans. And I thought AA was just like a secret society of drunks. I've seen it a couple times mentioned on TV. It really wasn't, man. I got hugs and, you know, I didn't smell very good. You know, I only showered maybe once or twice a week and only got to wash my clothes maybe every other week. So I know I didn't smell good. And people were hugging me. And there was free coffee and some muffins and stuff. I was like, this is cool, man. I can eat and get some hugs and talk to people. And I talked to the reverend after the meeting. He's like, "Oh, I got a bed for you. That's a sober living." I was like, "Oh, okay, cool." I didn't really know if I wanted to get sober. I really didn't have any intentions to get sober. So I didn't know this at the time, but looking back, I was so full of fear. I walked out of that meeting hall and walked halfway down Sierra Highway, about a mile, and didn't want to go. I was so scared. I didn't know what the hell was going to happen. My mom ended up seeing me walking and brought me back, and I said, "All right, man, I'll give it a chance. I got nothing else to lose. I'm going to go live under a bridge, so at least I'll have a bed to sleep on if I do this." Next thing I know, I'm on the back of a motorcycle without a helmet going up to the sober living. Yeah, my roommate was a motorcycle guy. So I do this, I get in there. You know, I'm starting to eat, which was great. I didn't have any food, and, you know, the bed was... That was pretty much all that kept me sober, was the fact that I was eating every day and sleeping. And I said, if I need to stay sober to get these basic necessities of life, then so be it. So I had this roommate, the one with the motorcycle. He was a jaybird, so to say. Did 30 years in prison. And had only been out of, I don't know, a couple months. You know, a lot of stuff changes over 30 years. He was in his 60s, man. I was like 21. So we didn't have anything in common. So I was living with him, man, and I just did... I've never been incarcerated. I don't know what the hell prison or jail is like. And I just did little stuff that just, like, irritated the living hell out of him. Like, I wouldn't turn the shower knob all the way so it would drip. And I'd open up the blinds, and he still likes to live in a cave. So I'd open up the blinds and keep it peaked, and he'd slip his wig, man. And just one day, he just blew up on me out of anger and said, "You're never going to stay sober." And my first 90 days of sobriety was straight up resentment to show him, look, I'm going to stay sober. That was my first 90 days. My first week of sobriety, though, was I kept going to the AA meetings, man, and every time I would go to the AA meetings, I'd get asked the same question, "Hey, you got a sponsor?" It's like, no, man, it was just like my second day of doing this. I would have a sponsor. So I got really tired of hearing this question of, "Do you have a sponsor?" So by the fourth day, I had obtained this sponsor. He had what I wanted. He had this family, you know, kids, a house. He had a military career. I always wanted to join the military. I was like, all right, cool. You're going to be my sponsor. That way when I go to meetings and they keep asking me if I have a sponsor, they're going to stop asking me. That wasn't the case. They just kept asking me and I had a different answer. So I thought I could fool you guys, but it really didn't work. So I did that. I did the first step with him. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Step one. I had some trouble with this step. I knew my life was completely unmanageable from living in a tent for 6 months. But what was powerlessness? I didn't know what powerlessness was, and I had to realize, you know, without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and living a spiritual life with these steps, you know, I'm powerless, man. I can drink, and then once I start, I'm not going to stop. You know, I had that obsession, I guess, for like the first 30 days. That's all I thought about. Anytime I'd smell some kind of substance being burned or saw a can, you know, that's all I thought about. So I was powerless. And somebody had to actually sit down and teach that to me. So I did that. Second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know what? I left a really big major part out of my story, and I need to go back. When I was 15, a few years after we moved to Santa Clarita, my father died of a rare brain disease called CJD. It's Krusep Jacobson's disease. The best way to describe it is the human version of mad cow. It deteriorated his brain from the inside out for 6 weeks. I literally watched my father go crazy. He would think that the dogs were in crates under the hospital bed. I think his last words, he pointed to the wall and said that'd be a great place to put a waterfall. It completely turned him crazy. So when it came to step two and three, I had resentments towards God of a religious understanding. God took away my father at the wrong time. God punished me. You know, I had to get past those religious resentments. And I'm so glad that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religious program, because I'd have told you to shove it up where the sun don't shine and walked out. You know, I got to the ability to make a power greater than myself to my own understanding, which is developed. My higher power is developed over time. You know, I think at first I had a lot of confusion about that higher power. You know, I didn't know what the hell they said. make something that you're not in control of. And somebody was trying to explain it to me and said, if you go stand in the middle of the street and tell the car to stop, it's not going to stop. I said, I'm not making a car my higher power. Sorry, bro. I'm not making the ocean waves a higher power. And I'm sure in the hell not making my higher power a doorknob. I've seen that doorknob, actually, at a convention. I've seen that original doorknob. Yeah, dude, so I had to come up with that higher power. And I used the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as my first higher power. I figured, you know, I don't know how to stay sober for at least a year, but somebody in this meeting obviously does. They've got words of wisdom. If I actually listen to them and see what they have to say, you know, that's probably God speaking through them, and that'll help me stay sober. And that's what I had to do. So I've turned our lives over to the care of God as we understood them. Now here's the part that I see a lot of people fall off at, the step forward, man, the searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. A lot of people start that, but they don't finish it. I finished it. I just wanted to get through these steps as fast as possible, because it was kind of like homework, and I don't like homework, so let's just get it done. That's kind of how I looked at it. So I made this list. It took me like 3 weeks. I worked on it, you know, maybe an hour or two each day. Remember, I was 21. I didn't have like the most wreckage in the world from my past. So I made this list. I went and I did step 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. I went and did that with my sponsor and my grand sponsor. I had about 90 days, a little over 3 months when I did this. And my sponsor, about a week after that, once again, he was in the military. He went to, not basic, but he went to training over there in Missouri. I can't remember the name of the base. Maytag probably knows. Albert knows. He went to Missouri, and he drank. He got drunk, man. I was like, oh, wow. You know, this is a guy that I just shared my deepest, darkest secrets with a week ago, and now he's drunk. What the hell am I supposed to do? So, I held on tight, man, to the people that I had grown to understand with, that, you know, took me through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, my grand sponsor. My great grand sponsor. I used to go to this meeting every Sunday that my great grand sponsor held at his house. There was probably about 40 of us that met every Sunday. He would cook dinner and then we'd read the big book on tape for an hour. So for about a month, I didn't have a sponsor. I eventually asked my great-grand sponsor to be my sponsor at that point. He was been sober for, I think, 25 years at the time. He was like a pothead like me, so I was like, okay, that's cool. I'll do that. So when I originally did my 6th and 7th step, was after I did my 4th and 5th step. They gave me this big book and said, okay, read this passage and meditate for an hour. I said, okay. There used to be this big hill behind the mobile home that I lived on. They said, go climb the hill and go read the passage. I said, okay. I felt like I did these steps wrong, and I'll explain why. So I went back and redid them. I went up there for an hour, and I read the passage, and I sat there in meditation for about 15 minutes, and then I fell asleep in the sun. I got sunburnt. And then on the way down the miniature hill, I fell down and landed in the L.A. Wash and sprained my ankle. So I felt I completely did those steps wrong, so I went back and redid those. man, I was red as a tomato after that day. So when I had actually gotten my grand sponsor to become my sponsor, or my great-grand sponsor, we went back and redid those. Once again, dude, I had to be taught these steps. I did not understand them. When it came to character defects, he said, we're going to do this in the most simplistic way as possible. He said, here's some words that are character defects that the majority of us have. You know, jealousy, anger, lust. He said, what I want you to do is I want you to write these words on a flashcard. Each morning when you wake up, take a flashcard out and work on this character defect for the day. I walked around for 3 months with flashcards in my back pocket. You know, so that was the most simplistic way that somebody could teach me how to do that, to understand what the hell a character defect was. So we did the 7-step prayer, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Made a list, step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I took the list out of my fourth. I didn't burn it. I still have it to this day. It's in a drawer that nobody's going to go through. I took that list and made it, took the names off of that and made my eighth step 8 list. I made my direct amends to such people. You know, of course, mommy and the relatives, they were up to hear that. And, oh, okay, we love you, just stay sober and stuff. But I want to talk about some of the people that I did make an amends that weren't so positive about it, because you don't really hear that in meetings. I remember I had gotten into an argument with what was once a really good friend before I got sober. He was holding a lot of my stuff because I was living in a tent. We got into an argument and he threw all my shit on the side of his house and said, come get it. So I got into a really big argument with him. I found him. He lived down the street from my mom's house. My mom was out of town. And I was watching her house for Thanksgiving. It was Thanksgiving Day. And I saw him walking to the local 7-Eleven down the street. So I was being dropped off at my mom's house. My mom lived on this really big hill. I ran all the way down to the hill just to catch him at the light before he got home. I went there and I said, hey, man, I wanted to talk to you. And turned around to me and said, fuck off, I don't want to talk to you. And just went our separate ways, man. He wasn't willing to hear me. That's how bad I had made wreckage in my past. You know, I had harmed him. So, you know, not everybody was receptive to the fact that I was sober and wanted to hear what I had to say. Moving along, continued to take personal inventory and when wrong, promptly admitted it. You know, I'm kind of a dick, so if you hear me cuss you out, I'm sorry. I will apologize if I catch it. I gave the AT&T guy some attitude yesterday and had to apologize. You know, so, you know, I'm not perfect, man, and I do have my issues. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. If you want to know the truth, this is probably the step that I struggle with the most. Out of all the ones that I've seen people go out on, the 11th step is probably the one I struggle with the most. The prayer and meditation. You know, I don't have that down to a T. I do talk to my higher power. I definitely don't meditate. Sorry to say it. I'm not a meditation guy. The Garden of Zen thing's not for me. So it is a work in progress when it comes to the 11th step. Having had a spiritual awakening, step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So, man, I was 12-step in like a month afterwards. I've been told I have a good heart and I'll go out of my way for people. You know, when I was newly sober, I didn't have the accessibility that I did with some of the materialistic items that I have, such as a car and a place to live, you know. But I would do the little things. I remember there was a gentleman, he came to a meeting, and he needed to walk about a mile and go past several liquor stores, and he thought if he did that by himself, he was not going to stay sober. I walked with that gentleman a mile in the L.A. desert heat to keep him sober and keep myself sober. You know, little stuff like that. I had food stamps at one point. I was buying people food. You know, they're still grateful for that today. But as I said, I've had a lot of issues, and I've had to learn a lot of stuff the hard way. There's kind of a rule of thumb some people talk about not dating in your first year of sobriety. I completely broke that rule of thumb and got a girlfriend at 90 days. Not only did I get a girlfriend, but I got an active alcoholic girlfriend. There is nothing worse than being sober and having to kiss a girl that's mouth and breath tastes like straight vodka. So, I had this girlfriend, man, and it ended horribly. My mom had ended up moving up here to Tulare County, but still had her house in Los Angeles. So I was watching it without my mom's understanding. I had invited this girlfriend to live at her house, and it ended horribly, man. I ended up getting my mom's computer stolen and having to pay her back and kicking this girl to the curb. And that's really all I'm going to say about it, because as far as my story is concerned, that's all that it is. Her story is hers. So that ended horribly, man. You know, I tried to get somebody sober that did not want to get sober, and I had to learn that the hard way. You know, I've learned a lot, and I've had to see a lot. You know, I tried to get in service as much as possible. When I got here, I've secretaried meetings. I make the coffee for this meeting. You know, as I said, you want good coffee, go to Starbucks. It tastes nasty to me, but I still drink it. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not good coffee. I don't care what meeting you go to. I've got to see things, man. I've got to see people that have not stayed sober. I've met old-timers that have stayed sober and passed away. I've gotten to see the real reality. The longer you stay here, the more you see. You know, when I had about 3.5 months sober, I saw the first death in Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't pretty. Excuse me. The gentleman couldn't get sober, and with 2 weeks, he was found behind a 7-Eleven with a plastic bag over his head. That's the kind of death that I've seen. I think the second death I saw was a man in a blackout trying to poke the L.A. County Sheriff with a stick. They shot him to death. You know, sometimes I hear about the heroin addict that's found dead with a needle in her arm with rigor mortis. You know, I've seen that kind of stuff and heard that stuff. I've also seen the beautiful ones, the beautiful incidences. You know, I believe, and this is just my belief, you can correct me if you have a different opinion, I believe that you beat the disease of alcoholism when you die sober. That is the finish line. That is my belief. And I've seen that. I've seen people, you know, old-timers pass on, and thousands and hundreds of people attend their funeral. I don't think I would even got 100 people to attend my funeral if I died before I got sober. I don't think I'd get 100 people to go to my funeral tomorrow either, but, you know, I've seen the lines of people that are respected that have decades of sobriety time. You know, I've gotten to experience things that I wouldn't have cared about when I had 30, 60, 90 days sober, you know, and get appreciation. I've been to Skid Row, the world famous drifters meeting on Skid Row on St. Julian in South downtown Los Angeles. You know, those are things that will humble you. I've been to international meetings, I've been to meetings in London. You know, that's stuff that I have appreciation for. The other week, my sponsor asked me to come over, and we listened to a speaker take of Bill Wilson, you know, on the day that Dr. Bob died. I would have had no appreciation for that before. You know, life is completely different. I have appreciation for just alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous in general today, you know. I have a beautiful life. You know, I have the material possessions now, a bed to sleep in, food stamps. You know, a car. I'm able to go to school. I've been a student for almost a little over two years, you know. I'm going for an AA degree right now in administrative justice. Who would have thought, going from gang fights and all that other stuff that I did to wanting to become a, you know, law enforcement. I never saw that happening. You know, the ultimate goal is to become a U.S. Marshal. I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's the goal that I've set for myself. You know, I've gotten to make real friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I spent almost 2 years in a sober living, so sorry, guys, those of you in a sober living, I don't feel bad. Do 2 years and then come talk to me. You know, so, you know, I've made lifelong friends. I'm young, dude. Most of my friends are old. Sorry, guys. That's just how it is. Most of my friends are old. Whatever. You know, but I keep in contact with them, you know. They want me to go down south next month to go celebrate 50 years with a gentleman that's, you know, celebrating 50 years sober. I wouldn't have cared about that before. You know, so that's a beautiful thing. You know, I want to thank everybody that came to hear me speak tonight. I appreciate that. You know, that shows the support that I have, you know. And it's greatly appreciated. I remember that kind of stuff, you know. How much time I got? Well, let's see if I can ramble on for another 5 minutes. You know, stay sober, guys. There's a life to be had here, and miracles. I've seen them. You know, they've happened to me. I don't have all of the things that I want in life today, but I am content where I am. You know, I've come a long way. I really have. You know, I get to be to service to other people today. You know, I know the success rate is really low. Let's not beat around the bush. As I said, I spent sober living for 2 years. I think in 2.5 years, only about 7 of us are still sober out of the hundreds that I've seen come and go. So, you know, today we're all the lucky ones because we get to sit here in this room today. But, you know, as I explained, there is the death, the horrible alcoholic's death. You know, stick around, get close, grab a sponsor, do these steps. You know, it might not be something that you want to do, but I guarantee it'll save your life. You know, as I said, I haven't always done this program right. You know, I've had my incidences. When you're at when you're in Southgate at 1 o'clock in the morning, trying to make a sale on an illegal object and get knives put to your throat, that's when you know you're not doing this program correct. So, you know, I haven't done this program correct, guys. I've had to learn the hard way. It's kind of like School of Hard Knocks. You know, it's just I guess for me, trials and tribulations, I've got to learn what works and what doesn't. You know, but I stayed sober through all that. I've had a brother that's died in sobriety and stayed sober. I almost lost my sister back here in April. She's 17. You know, the health complications. I stayed sober through that, you know. I've had to miss holidays with my family to stay sober, you know. I think I had like 9 months, and they wanted me to go on a cruise ship to Mexico for like a week and a half. I wouldn't have came back sober. Are you kidding me? I've been stuck on a boat for 5 days. What do you think I would have done? Last time I went to Mexico, I came back with pounds of green stuff. I wouldn't have stayed sober. So, you know, I get it. We had to do what we had to do to basically survive, at least in my instances, before we got sober. But today, it's different. I don't have to live by those standards. My standards have grown. You know, I'm a respectable member of the society that we live in. I don't always agree with society, but I am a respectable member of that. You know, we all have our views differently. I just feel what's kept me sober and that what I've learned to keep me sober. So, with that, I think I'm going to wrap it up. So, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Zach. The Valley Group encourages sponsorship and service to our fellowship. We invite you to come early and stay after the meeting to get better acquainted with our fellowship.